The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. As Teddy Roosevelt would say, bully, and we are delighted to welcome you. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Neil Langto. Historian Neil Langto is the author of Campy, The Two Lives of Roy Campanella and Negro League Baseball, The Rise and Ruin of a Black Institution, referred to by the New York Times as a prodigiously researched and enormously important historical corrective to feel-good versions of baseball integration. The recipient of the Seymour Medal from the Society for American Baseball Research, he has published articles in Smithsonian Magazine, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the Baltimore Sun, among other periodicals. He joins us tonight with his latest book, The Approaching Storm: Roosevelt, Wilson, Adams, and Their Clash Over America's Future. That's Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Jane Addams we're talking about. In it, he details the early 20th century rift between three of the United States' most important progressives as the country struggled to respond to the global consequences to World War I. What's old is new again, apparently. The Seattle Book Review praises it thusly: "The Approaching Storm brings the reader on a journey whose destination is preordained. However, the people and circumstances that guide the way form the crux of a brilliantly told history. The heart of the book consists of the three robust personalities caught in the middle of a rapidly escalating situation." Author Neil Langto relates the past with elegance and flair. This evening's author will be joined in conversation with John M. Cooper. His many historical works include Pivotal Decades, The United States, 1900 to 1920, The Vanity of Power, American Isolationism, and the First World War, 1914 to 1917, and Woodrow Wilson, A Biography, which was a finalist for the 2009 Pulitzer Prize. The recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and a Fulbright Professorship in Moscow, Russia, he is Professor Emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Neil, John, thank you both so much for joining us tonight, and take it away.
Nice to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Neil, as I told you before we came on the air, I like your book very much, and there's not a lot I can quarrel with. So I hope this that doesn't make for a dull evening. I do particularly like the way you did this triangulation, that you have the three of them. I think that's a very nice way of doing it. You've got TR on one side, you've got the hawk, and you've got Jane Addams on the other side, the dove, and you got Woodrow Wilson in between. Those terms, you know, hawk and dove, come from the 1960s from Vietnam, but the idea was there already. And I'm sure you saw this was a cartoon in 1915 by the best editorial cartoonist of the time was Roland Kirby in the New York World. And what he's got is he's got Wilson standing there kind of doing a shrug, what do I do, in the middle. And behind him on one side is Theodore Roosevelt, you know, in his full cowboy garb, blazing away with 2 6 guns. And over his other shoulder is William Jennings Bryan, who indeed is holding a birdcage with a dove in it. So this, you know, Wilson trying to make his way between the two extremes, Scylla and Charybdis. And I think it's nice that you've got Jane Addams instead of Bryan, although, you know, Bryan, of course, figures in this story a lot too. So no, I like very much the way you did that.
Well, thank you very much for saying that. And I thought it was good to get Addams in there because she's someone who's been so forgotten. And she was such an enormously important figure, an enormously important progressive. And I feel like every time I've done an interview for this book, everyone's asked me, well, the first question I have to ask you is, who's Jane Addams? Which is such a shame that in the 21st century, has been virtually forgotten, when in her own time, she was so unbelievably famous and important and influential. And I think she's someone who was not a politician. If I put Bryan in there, then you've got three politicians, and she at least reflects someone who's outside that sphere, and he was purely her feet purely planted in the pacifist movement, and also that she knew the other two so well. So that was another thing that made her appealing as a figure in this book, as part of this triangle. And you can see in this book how she starts as a TR supporter in 1912 with the Progressive Party. And eventually when the war begins, the European war, she begins to see that it's Wilson who is a better horse to back, even though she's aware of his flaws, just as she's aware of Theodore Roosevelt's flaws. But I think she was very much a pragmatist who knew very much what she was doing and felt that she was going to work with whomever could hopefully get her goals achieved best.
Well, you did convey very well that early support of TR. And you're right. I mean, as you point out in the book, she was the most famous woman in America. I mean, she commanded enormous attention and enormous respect. But there was always, as you say, there was always a certain lack of comfort between the two of them. I mean, T.R., on the other hand, he backed woman suffrage. He was fine for that. But he said privately that was not a big deal with him. You know, that's just another issue. That was nothing that he, well, I'd say he didn't care about it, but he didn't make that a great priority. And of course, Jane Addams was always uncomfortable with T.R.'s militarism. By the way, several T.R. aficionados have objected when I use the term militarist to describe T.R. And I'm sorry, if we've ever had a true militarist in American history, he's certainly right up there near the top of the list.
He would object to that, as he did many times in 1915, 16. You know, he would always say that during my presidency, no American soldier was killed. And, you know, I kept peace and I have a Nobel Peace Prize. He said that to Jane Addams one time when she was quarreling with him about something, saying, look, I am a man of peace. The way I achieve peace is different from Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson tried to use words which don't achieve anything, but I in my heart am more of a peacemaker than him. Of course, this was TR's slant on things. So he never fancied himself a militarist, but I think I would agree with you that he certainly was far more in that direction.
That's interesting, you know, that he was fine. Good for him to be proud that there was no war, you know, no American soldier ever got killed. Well, there's the Philippine insurrection was going on. But yeah, on the other hand, in 1910, you know, when he went off, what he did when he left the presidency, which he hated to do, he terribly hated to do. That was the one job that he'd ever had that really satisfied him and could satisfy him. He tried to make as much space as he could for his successor, William Howard Taft. And he did the closest thing he could to getting off the planet, which was he went off on a safari in what they then called Darkest Africa. I mean, the point is, it was outside communications. It wasn't easy to communicate. So he was getting himself off. And then he did this triumphal tour of Europe and gave a number of different talks, which are at different places. He got an honorary degree from Oxford, an honorary degree from Cambridge, an honorary degree from the Sorbonne, and all of that. And one of them, though, he reflects. He said, basically, it takes a great crisis, a great event to make a great leader. And he said that once he said, where would Lincoln be if it hadn't been for the Civil War? And he said that full of regret because, no, he didn't have a war under his presidency. In one way, more than one way, he wished he had. And I think that has a lot to do then with this furious feud between him and Wilson, which is there's more heat and passion on TR's side in that than there is on Wilson's. But an awful lot of that goes into that, this regret that the great crisis, he didn't have the great crisis to make him a great president as he viewed things.
Yeah, I mean, he perceived this as the most significant event in the last 100 years. And it was killing him. I think it actually was killing him that he was not president when this was happening, and that this man who he did not like at all was in the driver's seat. I think if Taft had been there too, it would have killed him. But I think particularly Wilson, who he hated more, certainly he had feelings for Taft at one point, but he just wanted to be there so much. And I think he couldn't be there, number one, and then he couldn't get back in the presidency, and then Wilson wouldn't let him go over, of course. So there were all these terrible disappointments that he faced in the final years of his life, I think was really difficult for him. It's sort of a sad story in some ways, these years for Roosevelt. I mean, because he's kind of pushing against the tide most of the time until he finally starts gathering a little bit of steam and a little bit more support. But in his letters, and I'm sure you've read many of his letters as well, he'll say kind of sadly, like, oh, I'm lucky if I have 3% of the population following me right now. And then maybe 6 months later, he says, well, maybe I have a little few more followers now, maybe 10% of the country. Most of the country doesn't understand me, thinks I'm a bad person, and they'd rather listen to Mr. Wilson and his dignified talk than hear what I have to say. So I think there is a great deal of sadness on his part that he's just not in the driver's seat, and that the people seem to have turned away from him, you know, at one point when the people were following him. And even, I think there's a letter, I think it was at the time of the Lusitania, where he wrote a letter, I think to, might've been Kermit, one of his sons. He said something like, for 20 years, everything went my way, like between 1890 something and 1910. And in the last 5 years, everything has gone against me. So I think he felt that everything had turned in another direction. I mean, his life had turned upside down, and his health was deteriorating too. So that was another piece of the puzzle that made life so difficult for him at this time.
Do you think that that expedition he did down to the Amazon weakened his health? But how much do you think that contributed to to this deteriorating health and then an early death? I mean, he was just a little bit past his 60th birthday when he died.
I think it had to have because you see when he comes back in 1914 and all these letters of constantly him saying, I have the fever. And then people are writing him these crazy letters about what he should do. You know, it's like rub pickle juice on your forehead or something. I mean, everyone's got these suggestions of what he should do for the fever. And sometimes it goes away and sometimes it comes back. But I think that weakened him tremendously. And I think he never quite got his health back 100%. There are times when the press says, oh, he looks good. Mr. Roosevelt's looking back fit as a fiddle, but he didn't have the vitality that he had before. And I think he never really quite recaptured that. And that's what's so also so strange is that he somehow thought he could go fight, you know, a man who was not in very good shape and was overweight. I think he was even an old 50 something, you know, even for the times for 1916, 1917, he was an old 57, 58 year old man. He didn't take care of himself. And he had this idea he's going to go over and somehow be in the trenches and doing whatever. Although I think he wanted to die. You know, he wanted to die in action. I think that would have been for him, a perfect way to end his life would be dying on the battlefield and doing what he believed was so important. But
in 1912, he took a bullet. You know, there was an assassination attempt when he was campaigning. And I've said this, David McCullough said it, a bunch of them. I think he was sorry that he didn't die, because he went on. He was shot in the chest, suffering from shock, loss of blood. But he insisted on going on and giving his speech, and it reads like a dying declaration. That I have never been prouder. He compares that campaign he was doing for the progressives as like leading his troops in battle, and I think it's horrible to say, but I think he really regretted that he didn't die there, because that was the perfect exit from the stage, and it didn't happen.
It was a little bit of martyrdom, I suppose, opposing him, and it would fit. It certainly fits perfectly for his personality, his psyche, that would be appealing to him. And dying in action and going over there and taking a bullet. Would have been the way to end his life, and again, sort of show he was more of a man than Woodrow Wilson. I think too would have been another way of fulfilling that need.
You've touched on a couple of things I'd like to bring up. One, you mentioned how he was overweight. For some reason, he never dieted. He was a not quite a glutton, but close enough to it. And one time there's, you know, that photo of him when he came back from South America from that. That's the only time I've ever seen, well, except earlier in his youth, a skinny TR. when maybe he had his, thanks to those fevers and everything, maybe he had his weight right temporarily. And, eventually, I think in some ways, I think probably his history of overweight did contribute to his death, because it was an aneurysm. It was something, you know, related to the blood system and probably to blood clots. So that the other thing, though, is I liked what you said, Neil, when you said proving that he was more of a man than Woodrow Wilson. That's when you get to TR, you get into the history of masculinity and of conceptions of masculinity. And it's interesting that TR and Wilson are two of, I think, of only three presidents since the Civil War who've been genuine intellectuals. They really were. I mean, Wilson, it's obvious, our only PhD, our only professional academic, great educator, so forth. TR, as his published writings are enormous. I think he probably wrote more for publication than any other president before or since. And at various times in his life, that was his chief source of income, was writing for publication. So here's a man who he knew five or six languages. He taught himself Icelandic as an adult so he could read the Norse sagas and the originals. I mean, this is an extraordinarily learned man. And yet he picks away, he goes in for anti-intellectual stereotypes against Wilson, that, you know, both of them had lost sight or much sight in one eye. And he said, oh, well, I got mine. It was a boxing accident when he was president. You know, he's boxing with a young Navy lieutenant. And he said, but President Wilson, of course, he's got it from too much reading. He had a term. I've never seen it anywhere else before. He called Wilson a logothete or a Byzantine logothete.
Byzantine logo. I thought that was one of the things that made me laugh in my research when they had the press going around and asking him, what does that mean? And he started spouting all these different books, and go read these books. You'll learn exactly what a Byzantine logothete was. Well, and then they go back to him and say, there's nothing in there about Byzantine logo. It's just like some weird thing that he picked up on.
He said, Wilson, what he meant, he said, he uses big words to confuse honest men. You know, it borders on anti-intellectualism, and it borders on, it is gender stereotype. That's what he's doing there. And in 1912, the stories were getting out about Wilson's relationship, some would call it an affair, with Mrs. Peck. And TR's campaign said, well, Colonel, Mr. President, why don't we use it? And some people say, oh, no, that he was too noble to do this. Oh, no, I won't stoop to that. No, that wasn't the reason. He said, I can't believe that people would believe that someone who looks so much like the apothecary's clerk could be Romeo. You know, in other words, this guy isn't going to appeal to any women. You know, he's not man enough for that. So, you know, these are the less attractive sides of TR. I know there's no question about that. And it's too bad, because it sullies his reputation.
Yeah, I mean, there's a letter, which I think I quoted in the book, where he actually said, I don't think Wilson's a real man or something. He actually said that. I mean, it was... But some of it was his hatred became so overwhelming, I think, during these years. I mean, you can just see it escalating letter after letter, his anger towards Wilson. And you also see, which I think is interesting, because I read the incoming correspondence to Roosevelt, and you see people writing him and saying, like, you know, Colonel, you really should tone down your attacks. It doesn't do you any good, you know. And I think it was, I don't remember who, one of TR's friends said something like, when you go after Wilson, it's like a heavyweight champion beating up some little guy, because people actually start sympathizing with Wilson because Wilson doesn't really fight back. And of course, Wilson strategically didn't fight back because he knew how much it irritated Roosevelt. Yeah. He specifically said, I will not answer him because I know how much it drives him up the wall. So Wilson knew what he was doing. But the more I think Roosevelt criticized him publicly, I think it really did not help him probably in the long run. I think it made people feel it was too personal, you know, and he had legitimate differences in policy with Wilson, which he probably could have stressed more tactfully, I think. But I think his thinking was a little bit, I don't want to say warped, but I think it was a little distorted at this time with respect to Wilson.
Yeah. I was interested in the relationship of Jane Addams and the Women's Peace Party to Wilson, because they're back and forth. I think he had some genuine sympathy with them, but I think he was also using them. It seems to me that this is one flank that he wants to make sure that he's protected himself there. Wilson was never a pacifist. You know, T.R. wanted to make him seem like one, or thought he was one, and of course he meant that totally pejoratively. But Wilson was never a pacifist. He never, you know, one thing when I worked on him, I tried my darndest to find maybe some kind of childhood memories of the Civil War and in the South that had scarred him or gave him these attitudes. And I couldn't find them. And that's maybe, they're not there. He was not that affected that way by the Civil War. He was a real enthusiast for the Spanish-American War, the next war that came along. Unlike T.R., he never thought of going and enlisting, but on the other hand, he was a vigorous supporter of the war. And when he became president, I think he even had a certain Rooseveltian, Theodore Rooseveltian itches there, that he was going to intervene down in Mexico. You know, he was going to practice good imperialism, and he got burned very quickly, and by and large learned his lesson from that. But when Wilson was hesitating and debating about whether to intervene, T.R., well, as you point out very well, Neil, T.R. was his pressure cooker was getting even higher and hotter. And he said, Wilson, what he wants to do is fight feeble war. You know, he misjudged Wilson badly. When Wilson decided to go into the war, okay, we'll fight, and we'll fight with all we've got. You know, Wilson didn't want to. What he did object to very much, came more and more, was the kind of carnage, the kind of, he called it mechanized slaughter, that World War I had turned into. And he's got one, I think you have it in there, one note, memo that he wrote to himself right after he got reelected, looking at the war, calls it a prolegomenon. And he said, war is deprived of its glory. Well, that's interesting, because here's a man who believed that in many circumstances or in the past, war had been glorious. And there were times when he said it would be glorious to die in battle. So Woodrow Wilson was not a pacifist, but he wasn't a militarist either.
Yes, I of course strongly agree with you on that. And I think he was misjudged to some degree by the pacifists, and they believed they had one of their own in the White House. And I think Wilson was very skillful in working them. I mean, I think he knew Jane Addams was important. There were 12 suffrage states, number one, at the time, I think in 1916. So mm-hmm. I think he knew that she commanded still some influence. And there were progressives who were part of the pacifist movement who might lean his direction. And I think it didn't take much for him simply, okay, I'll meet with them, I'll listen to their various proposals, and I'll show interest. And they seemed to be satisfied with that. They didn't lean on him that hard to do something. I think they wanted him to intervene in some way for peace. I think they, you know, Addams pressed him for that for 2 years. And of course, Wilson would say time and time again, time is not ripe, time is not ripe. We will do something, but it's not time right now. And they were satisfied with that up to a point. I think there were a few in the movement, people like Rosa Schwimmer, who were much more aggressive and felt that, you know, he's got to do something. He's got to push much harder. We need to push much harder on Wilson. But I think Addams herself was content to wait And certainly, you know, most of the pacifists supported Wilson in 1916. I think they figured he was a much better bet than a Republican administration with Hughes and with possibly Roosevelt in the background pulling the strings. And they felt that nothing would be accomplished if Hughes was in there. But I think I think one of my favorite parts in the book is when Adams goes to see Wilson in early 1917. And I think when she has this epiphany finally that, guess what? Woodrow Wilson doesn't necessarily feel the same way you do, when she's trying to convince him not to sever diplomatic ties with Germany and try to find some way out. And he tells her, you know, if we don't get involved in this war, I'll be lucky to get into the peace conference through a crack in the door. And I think at that moment, she's like, this is what it's all about for him. He wants to have this influence on the peace, and he's willing to go to war to have that influence on the peace. This is not how we think. We want to find every possible avenue to explore for peace. He's not willing to go as far as we are. And I think when she left that meeting, she realized that Wilson was not the person she thought he was. And I think some of the other pacifists were a little disillusioned with him in that regard.
Although that's interesting, because he did move for peace. You know, first, he had to get reelected. That's how he saw it. And once he did, first he sent that note, which he published, public note to all the belligerents, state your terms. That was the opening salvo in his peace campaign. And then the next one is peace without victory. He lays out a compromise peace. I mean, that was a very, very bold move that he did.
I think he was at that moment, his standing with the pacifists was at its highest. I think they were absolutely delighted, over the moon with him. Like, this is what we've been wanting him to do. And then, of course, no one knew that the Germans had already made their decision to resume unrestricted submarine warfare at that point. But I think there was a great deal of hope that something was going to happen in early 1917, but of course it did not.
No, and Wilson, that was his preferred, that was what he preferred. That's what he wanted. He really didn't want to be a war president. TR, of course, did. That would have been his fondest dream. But no, Wilson didn't want to be a war president. He wanted to bring about a compromise peace in Europe. And he spelled it out. And interestingly, in his war address, he said at one point, I have the same objects in mind that I did on January 22nd last, meaning in peace without victory. I mean, he was going to fight an all-out war militarily, but for limited ends. He more than once said, I don't want to go crush Germany. I don't want to, you know, have a smashing victor's peace. That's not right. That's not going to last. So, yeah, he's not with the pacifist, but he's not entirely against them either.
Well, here's a question for you, John. I'll turn the tables on you, because I've been asked this question. I'm curious what you think. Do you think Wilson could have avoided going to war in early 1917 if he had just said, no, we're going to simply arm the ships like they wanted to do, we are not going to formally declare war? Could he have survived it politically, do you think, and would the people have stood for it at that time?
Neil, I think the answer to that is yes, or probably. I mean, we're speculating. The there was no great groundswell for going into war. Pro-intervention sentiment had risen after the submarine attacks, but I found three different quite independent witnesses who said that when Wilson went up on April 2nd, 1917 to give his speech, in which he asked for war. First of all, nobody knew what he was going to say. You know, he did that. Believe me, there were no leaks. Three different people. One was Fiorello LaGuardia, who was a second-term congressman from New York. One was David Starr Jordan, a leading pacifist, the former president of Stanford. And one was the British ambassador. And they all said he could have carried Congress either way. You know, that he did have it in the palm of his hand. So he wasn't. Wilson, for such an educated man, he could also be extremely superstitious. And one superstition he had was that he might suffer the same fate as James Madison. In fact, at one point, when Colonel House puts it in his diary, that Wilson pulled down a volume from this book that he'd done, The History of the American People, and read something about Madison, how Madison was reluctantly forced into war by outraged congressional and public opinion. And he said, forced into war by the irritations, particularly of the British blockade. And he said, Madison and I are the only two Princeton men who've ever been elected president, and the circumstances run parallel. Well, he did not want to suffer Madison's fate, which was to be forced into a war that he didn't want. And he wasn't. No, the reason the United States went into World War I was because Woodrow Wilson decided to take the United States in. I mean, I think he could have held out there. Now that was, of course, the TR, Henry Cabot Lodge, the pro-Allied ones would have gone through the roof. Of course they would have. But on the other hand, there was plenty of support there. Several observers thought that, you know, that in voting for war, the Senate and the House, most of the senators and congressmen weren't quite sure what they were voting for. They certainly didn't think they were voting for a full-scale land war in Europe. They thought, well, all right, we'll have a naval war, you know, we'll defend ourselves against the submarines, and we'll supply some money to the Allies and maybe token forces. But no, there's no conception of that, and except in the mind of the man who took us into war. If we're going to go in, we're going to go in all the way.
It was very surprising to me when I was doing the research how many people did not think we were going to commit troops, as you just mentioned. When Wilson announced that, yes, we're going to build an army, yes, we're going to send them over, there was a lot of, I think, literal jaws dropping. They did not expect that to come out of him. Of course, TR was jumping for joy at that moment, but I think much of the country was very surprised.
Well, you know, the other thing is TR, you know, why you have TR hat literally hat in hand, going to Wilson and asking to be allowed to, you know, raise a division and lead them, and saying all kinds of things. Whatever I've said about you in the past, that's, what is it, like dust in a windy street, you know, and all that.
I would love to have been a fly on the wall at that meeting.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I can only imagine how it was for both of them. I mean, it must have been the most. They seem to have had a cordial chat, as far as you can tell from reading about it. I mean, we don't know, but it sounds like it went fairly well as it could go for two men who probably detested one another up to this point.
Well, you know, the funny thing, Neil, is at a certain point earlier in their lives, they'd been, I call them friendly acquaintances. They weren't quite close enough to call them real friends, but they had admired each other very much. And one of TR's great regrets was that he'd been in an automobile accident that prevented him from coming to Princeton when Wilson was inaugurated as president of Princeton. And they'd been mutually admiring for a while. And what is it, Joe Tumulty, you have to be careful. He had a somewhat vivid imagination or recollection. He said that, oh, about TR, he's a great big boy. You just can't help loving him. Well, yeah, I think I do. He was not immune to TR's charms. The War Department, the brass, the civilian leaders were all, to a person, opposed to TR division. I mean, first of all, as you point out, his health was bad. His military experience was outdated and not all that extensive. And plus, they wanted to raise an army in an orderly way, and bringing in the draft. They'd had certainly seen the problems that the Europeans, and especially the British, had had with the way they'd raised their forces, and they wanted to do it better, do it right. And every ambitious young officer in the army was clamoring to get into the Roosevelt Division. Of course, this was going to be the glamour thing. This was going to get the publicity. This was going to, you know, boost their careers enormously. And this went right down to Dwight D. Eisenhower, West Point class of 1915. They were all angling to get in there. And what they're saying, what the War Department is saying, this will destroy our attempts to have orderly, orderly raising of forces. And the point with the draft is to make sure that you're not taking too many people, men, out of critical occupations, to have some sort of organized way of keeping a wartime economy and boosting up a wartime economy. So I Wilson wouldn't have been human if he hadn't somewhat enjoyed being able to thwart his great rival there. But it certainly was not entirely personal, and I'm not sure it was even primarily personal.
Yeah, I mean, Baker, the Secretary of War, said, he said, I think it was one of his later interviews, maybe 10 years down the line, he said, the decision was made by me ultimately, and I made it because TR was simply not qualified to go over and lead and have any kind of involvement in military capacity. It would have been a disservice to the men he went over with, and it was as simple as that. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably a great deal of truth in what Baker was saying. He was unqualified. And as you said, the Army brass didn't want him either. So you combine those two things together, and then you have Wilson himself. Why is he going to do him a favor in the first place? All these things converging. And if Roosevelt had been in good health, I don't know if it would have made much of a difference. He was in poor health besides that as well. I think Pershing later said that, General Pershing said that TR was not even in good shape to be going over. So many, I don't know if TR was delusional, perhaps he was a little bit about his chances, but it seems like it was still incredibly crushing to him that when he was turned down.
Neil, I think you are extremely fair to TR. And when I say extremely, there's a little bite in that, because I think you take a more sympathetic view of him than I do. I think his jealousy of Wilson and his fury at being deprived of his moment in history, I think was not all consuming, but it was bad there. The other thing that I was glad to see you point out is that when the war first broke out, he was a bit ambivalent. Belgium, you know, these days they're comparing, and I said you had an op-ed piece where you were comparing Belgium to Ukraine today, you know, brave little Belgium. And of course that was, the British who used that as their excuse for getting into the war. TR was, his first reaction was, well, tough on the Belgians, but you know, they're just in the way. You know, they're, when these giants clash, and you know, his first reaction, he came around pretty quickly. But when he published those early writings there, and it was that Fear God, Take Your Own Part, I think that's the title of that collection. That early editorial that he op-ed that he wrote wasn't in there. You know, he conveniently tossed that aside. So he wasn't as clear and consistent as he very soon came to think he was.
To his great regret, I think you again in the correspondence you see letters almost every year saying, Colonel Roosevelt, is it true that early in the war you said that, you know, President Wilson's handling the Belgium situation and he shouldn't be proposing any sort of intervention or whatever, and he had to always refer back to that. It was in the Outlook is where those articles appeared, and his excuse was, well, I was giving the president a chance to formulate his policy, and then once I learned that he was completely wrong, then I realized that I had to change my stance on Belgium. And I think also, supposedly, I think when the Belgians came in September, some representatives from Belgium and came to see him and talk to him, he claimed that was another thing that pushed him in the more direction that Wilson had mismanaged and had miscalculated and simply had not done what the United States should be doing, at least protesting the Belgian invasion.
Oh, no, he went further than that. He said the Germans had violated the Hague Conventions.
Yes, he did say that.
And that we had an obligation to act somehow. Well, the implication, of course, is militarily, to act under the Hague Conventions. He said, what's more, I was president when we ratified those, and that's what I meant. Well, he's either deluding himself or he's lying through his teeth, because that when those Hague conventions went through, his bosom buddy, Henry Cabot Lodge, Senator Lodge, had to practically stand on his head in the Senate to say, no, there's no obligation under here. You know, we're not entangling ourselves at all. So, you know, TR had that, some say it's the politician's gift of believing what he needs to believe when he needs to believe it. And that's what he was doing. I mean, that's the kind of some of the things that he was doing. And I'm a little less charitable.
Well, yeah, I think your point is well taken. I think I tried to see things through his eyes when I could. His eyes were sometimes not always seeing perfectly clearly as they might. And some of it, I think some of his comments and his speeches were said through the, you know, they were very much shaped by the feelings of a man who was extremely angry and full of bitterness about his position and about the man in the White House. So I don't think he would agree with Wilson on anything. I mean, it's very hard to see. Very rarely do you actually see him in this period that I cover in this book where Roosevelt agrees with Wilson. I think when he got rid of Bryan, well, when Bryan resigned, this for those of you who are not aware watching this, he was Secretary of State, leader of the Democratic Party for many years, and Bryan resigned in 1915 after the Lusitania sinking because he didn't like the way the Wilson administration was handling this. And Roosevelt at the time said something like, I'm really glad. It looks like Wilson's finally going to be a man. Again, that manliness thing. But then he quickly, you know, that doesn't last long.
By the way, I want to remember to get in. I like very much the way you treat Colonel House. You're not fooled by it. And I'm still amazed at how many good historians and good writers over the years have been fooled by House. Jonathan Daniels once wrote a letter to me in which he called him, forgive me for the bad language, he called him that devious son of a bitch. And, that's my view of House too. There's something, it's fascinating. I mean, the fascinating thing is the House-Wilson relationship, that Wilson did have this close relationship. Whether it was quite as intimate as House thought it was, that's hard to say. One of the problems, of course, is, you know, the problem and the great, the great source is House's diary. Most of what we have about the relationship comes from House's diary, which means you're getting House's side of it. And most of the stuff where, you know, you're my second personality, if you're talking to Colonel House, you're talking to me, that comes out of House's diary. You know that? And I'm sure Wilson said things that could be taken that way. Wilson could be quite sentimental in some of his, the way he talked to friends and friends and family, and that House could put that spin on it. But House was, he very quickly got too big for his britches. In other words, he began to see himself as this master of diplomacy, this man who could do all these great things, and see himself as so much better at that than the president.
You know, I think when you start reading, and I'm sure you probably read much more of his diaries than I only read the period from this book from 1914 to 17. When you read them day by day, you do get a sense of this person, what he's all about. And the other thing that's I found so amusing, that the perception of him publicly, or that he promotes himself, that he's the man who wants nothing, the man who doesn't want power. He just wants to be of service to his friend. But when you read the diary, you see he does have a huge ego. He wants credit, and you almost start feeling he thinks he knows more than Wilson in just about everything. So that was the impression I started to get as I read more and more. I have a question for you too. Maybe you can answer this. Do you think that his diaries were written the same day, or were they possibly written after the fact, like several days later?
Usually, as I could recreate this, and Charles New, his latest biographer, has done this, he would dictate this to his secretary probably a day or two or 3 days after they happen. So it's not that he's not Samuel Pepys. It's not En Saut de Bed. He's not going up every night and writing it down. Sometimes there are some very curious omissions, the times when something important happens and House just doesn't have anything in the diary about it. You're right. I mean, he was clearly writing this for the future, for posterity, I can be this ominous grease now and in the shadows, but someday I'm really going to come out. And he did. I mean, it's interesting. A somewhat bowdlerized version of the diary was published in four volumes. He enlisted Charles Seymour, then a young historian at Yale who'd been on the peace conference staff, and had him do what are called the intimate papers of Colonel House. In other words, he doesn't want just posthumous credit. He's going to get in there and get the credit while he was alive.
Very interesting man. Very, very, very complex individual. As you said, his diaries are a treasure trove, but they have to be used, I think, carefully. Yeah. You can't accept them on face value because of all the possible biases built into them.
There's one, the only time that we have Wilson talking about House, in other words, where you get Wilson's side of it, it's just once. When he started courting Edith Galt, he immediately shared all kinds of secrets of state and things with her. I mean, it's a courtship device, of course, to attract her, and it worked. But she took a dislike to House immediately, before she ever met him. Just she didn't like the smarmy tone of his letters. So Wilson says, no, you must understand dear House. And he said, you're quite right. He is not a mind of the first class. But he's saying basically he's useful and he's serviceable. And you can see that Wilson, at least at that point, was taken in by this man who only wants to serve. But clearly, and interestingly, many years later in his war memoirs, Lloyd George said pretty much the same thing. And I think, and without having read that letter either, he said House wasn't as smart as he thought he was. He was a tactician, a negotiator, but not nearly of Wilson's depth of mind. And he said something like, he would have been a good ambassador, but not a very poor foreign secretary. So, you know, House obviously had his limitations and was not as good as he thought he was.
Definitely, definitely.
Neil, what do you think surprised you the most in what you found here?
I think there are a lot of interesting things that I wasn't aware of. I think the potential of Roosevelt getting the nomination in 1916 seemed, I was surprised that it was even as close as it became to fruition, actually reaching fruition, of him trying to maneuver into somehow getting this nomination. And then even the last minute back and forth where you have these very interesting, those conversations which were recorded. Roosevelt had a wiretap, an intentional wiretap at the hotel. So you have Roosevelt communicating with the progressives, you have the Republicans talking to him, and all this is recorded, these conversations of them trying to come to some sort of agreement. And then Roosevelt realizing, I'm not going to get the nomination, but maybe I can be a kingmaker. I'll see who I can throw up there. The Republicans will follow my lead. He throws up Henry Cabot Lodge, which was not a particularly good idea. I found that really, really interesting, that part of the my research. Something else I found interesting was Bernstorff, which we haven't talked about, Johann von Bernstorff. And the efforts that he made, these prodigious efforts to keep the United States out of the war, and him sort of being the one rational figure in the German government who understood that America is this incredibly powerful force. And the people in Berlin, the folks back in Berlin, basically thinking, oh, America's insignificant. Who cares if they get involved? And he's trying to explain to them again and again, we have to keep them out of the war. Also found it interesting of the wiretaps they were doing on him, which I was able to see in the Frank Polk papers, I didn't even know there was possible to do wiretaps in 1915. I don't know if you ran into this, name your own research of these wiretaps. They were tapping the embassy. I mean, it's really, really interesting to me. I did not know that they had the capability to do that, and that the Germans didn't know about it, that Bernstorff didn't know about it. And they're all carrying on affairs. They're all having affairs with American women. Bernstorff's having an affair. A couple of others in the embassy are having affairs. All this is caught on these transcripts. And you even have the Secret Service men making little remarks, making fun of their affairs and what the women are saying and all this stuff like that. All of this was known. And House does mention it in the diaries. I think someone went to talk to him about it, and House said, "I do not approve of these methods," but they continued doing it. I think till 1917, these wiretaps, but I really did not know the technology existed in 1917, 16 to do this kind of thing.
Neil, we've got some questions in the Q&A, and several of them come back. What's it like to write? One says, "What's it like to write a book like this?" And another says, "A book of this scope." I'd be very interested to hear your take on that.
I think it's a massive undertaking, and again, you would understand this because you've written large books. But I think it's the sources. There's so much from this period. It's almost overwhelming. In contrast to what I've done before, the work I've done before was on the Negro Leagues. And the sources are rather scant for that. You have basically the African-American newspapers and a few manuscript collections, not that many. In this period, there's so much. I always say COVID kind of saved me because I would have been continuing to ply the archives for another 3 years, turning up every possible lead. And there are just so many documents. And I really just focused because it was out of control. Otherwise, I tried Adams, Roosevelt, and Wilson as my major things where I tried to read everything they did in those years. Even that was really overwhelming. And the newspapers too, which are such great resources for this time. Every big city had several newspapers, and they all had different, they covered the news differently. They have Republican newspapers, Democratic newspapers, and just to read all of them, I think fun to do, but very time consuming. And then trying to put all this together, I always use the analogy of it's like putting together a puzzle, which is supposed to have 100 pieces, but you have 5 million pieces. It's like, what pieces are you going to use and to assemble and to use and reject? And there's so many fascinating things that you want to use, but then you end up with a 600-page book like I have here. But I didn't try to write a 600-page book. I tried to write a book that would tell the story, and it happened to turn out that long. But to do justice to the subject, I felt it needed to be in this depth. But it is a great deal of work. I think the research is always the more fun part of the job than the writing is the more arduous. And I think, it can be backbreaking trying to put these things together. And, you've written many books and you've.
I had a scientist friend of mine once asking me how I was doing. I said, "Oh, I finished the research on it." And he said, "Oh, well, then you're almost done." I said, no. Comes the hard part. There's one question here that it's directed at me, and I can answer it very quickly. I said there were three true intellectuals as president since the Civil War. And who's the third one? Barack Obama. He is.
Yes.
He really is.
Yes.
Let's see. This is an interesting comment. TR had a solid 40 years of living that 99% of us would love to have in 5 years of our life. Yeah, certainly. One of his favorite expressions was the crowded hour, and crowded hour was when you live to the fullest. And at the end of his life, of course, the terrible blow was that his youngest son Quentin was killed. Quentin was an aviator, and he was shot down and killed. And he said, though, Quentin has had his crowded hour, and by the way, Neil, I'm sure you listened to every recording you could of all three of them. But people always ask me, "Well, what did TR sound like?" And I said, "Listen to FDR," and then kind of speeded up version of FDR, because it's that northeastern upper class accent that they have. And they always said, and they didn't say again, they said again, against, and they would swallow a lot of R's. Things like that. Have we got any more? Neil, I'm going to let you have the last word here, because this goes right to your op-ed. How do you think these players would act today toward Ukraine?
Well, as I said, in the op-ed, I did discuss some of these issues. I think Wilson would be comfortable with what Joe Biden is doing. I think he would be quite supportive of that and not going further. And I think Jane Addams would be, but Jane Addams would be saying we need to do more to stop this through peaceful means, find a way to get the Russians to stop this invasion. Even we have to somehow get them to broker an agreement. She'd be trying to get the United States to throw its power and its weight onto the scales for peace. I think Roosevelt would be advocating a more aggressive policy. I don't know about military intervention, but probably everything short of military intervention. Like I said in the op-ed, it's all depends on what the American public will stand for. And I think that was true in 1914 with Belgium, where a lot of Americans were very sympathetic to Belgium, but would they have been happy with troops being committed, even if we had troops, which we didn't really have? Probably not. And I think right now it's the same thing. There's a great deal of sympathy for Ukraine. Many Americans want to do what we can do, but there's a limit how much we will accept as a country. And then there's political considerations that Wilson had in 1914. You know, how's that going to play with the Democratic Party? I think Biden has to consider that as well. So it's an interesting thought. And I think they would realize the seriousness of the current situation and recognize the parallels.
Well, I think we've used up our crowded hour. As I say, I'll put in, Neil's too discreet to do it, but I'll put in, buy this book. It's good. You'll really, really enjoy it.
Thank you very much. Very kind of you to say.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.